Mitchell, but oh, there he is. I'd like to bring up Mitchell K. from Middletown, New York.
All right, Mitchell K. from Middletown, New York.
No magic tricks in there, so.
No magic tricks in here either.
Okay, I am Mitchell Klein, and I am a recovered alcoholic. How is everybody doing today and yesterday and other than the little area? I see everybody's wearing their winter coats. And all right, you know, one of the things, you know, talking about the history of AA for me really begins with kind of telling part of my story, and how I got interested in the history and what you know, what led me to look about the history and read about it and try and understand it. To kind of like, it was funny, Bill just asked me like, you know, how long am I going to be speaking for? And there was a line that my sponsor always gave once. They said, how long are you going to be speaking? You know, what are you going to be speaking about? And what is it? Well, about 2-3 hours. And I said, no, I can't do that. He could have, but I definitely can't. I became an alcoholic somewhere between the age of 13 and 14. I had people over at my parents' apartment, and we were having a party, and I kind of broke into their booze supply, and I took a sip. I didn't like it at all. I couldn't stand it. It burned. It kind of like made my eyes water. It just, I wanted to throw up. I took another sip. And then I took a little larger sip, and probably within about half an hour, 45 minutes, it felt good. No longer burned, no longer made me feel nauseous. I fit in. I was part of the crowd. I told jokes. I did all kinds of other fun stuff, and I was off and running from that point on, and I found, you know, alcohol was this wonderful thing. My parents never believed I was an alcoholic, even though that what they did was they took all the alcohol in the house, and because they used to have in this cabinet, and when they had company, what happened was is that they took the bottles out, and they were all empty, and it was kind of embarrassing for their company and them to be served nothing, and they wanted to know where it went to, and I said it evaporated. It was, you know, it's in a closet, it's hot, you know. So then they bought more, and then the other supply evaporated. And then what they did was they took an old toy chest of mine, and they my father, you know, took a screwdriver and a whole thing and put a little padlock on it and a clasp and stuck it in his, you know, in his closet, and said, like, you know, we're not going to be embarrassed again. And being an alcoholic, I took a flashlight and a screwdriver and unscrewed the hinges in the back. And they had company, and it evaporated in the toy chest. And then the next time, I filled it up with water mixed with tea. So it didn't evaporate, but it tasted real bad. So that was my introduction to alcohol. And around the same time, Better Living Through Chemistry. It was beautiful. I fit in. I was able to dance. I was able to make friends. I was able to make enough money to buy a car. One of the things I used to work in the treatment industry, and we help people put resumes together. And one of the things that I used out of my own bag of tricks was that I spent many years as an independent pharmaceutical salesperson. Looks good on a resume, but it's just, you know. So I just, you know, kept going, kept getting, you know, there was like a couple of years in my life. I still have no recollection of, you know, what they were. I would come down and, you know, be kind of straight for half a day just to see what that felt like. And that was a high for me because I, you know, but there are years I have no recollection of. Then I met the woman who was to be my first wife, and we got an apartment in you know, Pelham Parkway in the Bronx, and I kept drinking and stuff, and we were living there for about a year or so, year and a half, and my car kept getting broken into, and we decided to move up to Orange County, New York, where my parents had a summer home, and I've been going since I was 7 years old, so I was very familiar with the area. And we were renting a house. Now, one of the prerequisites for renting a house, I had my own silent prerequisite. It was across the street from a bar. So all I had to do, no DWIs. I just had to walk across the street and stagger across the street back. And that was, you know, it was fine. And it was a beautiful thing. And she started complaining, you know, that I kept losing jobs. None of my bosses that I worked for understood me, and we kept getting into arguments. And I would say, like, I only have maybe, I don't know, 2, 3, 4 drinks a day. And she pointed out they were in 16-ounce Burger King glasses, but I only had 2, 3, 4 drinks a day. And it got to a point where I was commuting into Manhattan, and at 4 o'clock in the morning I was sitting there pulling a bottle out from underneath the seat of my car and drinking, and people didn't want to sit next to me, and I couldn't figure that out either. So that went on for quite a while, and I just, not only the alcohol, I was eating my face, and I weighed close to 300 pounds. I was not a nice person. I remember one time we got into an argument. We had these, like, French doors in the house, and I just, rather than go off and whatever it is, I went and wanted to storm out of the house and put on a big show and pushed open the French doors, and I didn't hit the wood. I hit the glass. 57 stitches later, and the ambulance ride to the hospital, the doctor said I should drink some wine because it would be good for part of the healing process. And I had this big smile on my face, you know. So I did that, and she said, like, what are you doing? I said, the doctor told me. And if I was drinking at the time when they came out with, you know, alcohol is good for your heart, I would have done that as well. And what happened was is that she went down to Rockland County to another fellowship, Overeaters Anonymous. And I guess that meeting she was going to was being held at a place where there was an AA meeting. And what she did was she kept bringing home pamphlets. And she would say, read these. And I would say, I don't have a problem. And I would throw them out. And then she would bring home more next week. And it got to a point where she took all the magazines and stuff out of the bathroom and just left the pamphlet. So at 3:30 in the morning, as I'm sitting there, there's nothing to read. So I read these pamphlets, and it was wonderful that you people had a program that could help you with your problem. Yeah. It was a great thing, and I told her, thank you. You know, it increases my knowledge and increases my ability to help somebody. If I ever saw about somebody who was an alcoholic and needed help, I could tell them all about AA. Sooner or later, I kind of, I guess, got the message. And the way I got the message was I was down at my parents' apartment in the Bronx. I went for a conference for work down in Manhattan, and I was staying in their apartment. And because of past experience, I couldn't drink in their apartment. They wouldn't let me. They just didn't understand. So I took a walk, and I passed by a church. And in front of this church, there was a little silver and blue circle with, you know, with a triangle in the middle of it. And I, somewhere in the fog, recognized that sign and said, oh, that's that AA thing. So I figured, let me go in and check it out, you know. My life was falling apart. I kind of staggered through, you know, through the doors. I was, like I said, close to 300 pounds. I stunk. I was shaking. It was talked about greeters and the way they did things back in the old days. It was like I was greeted by, I was the youngest person in the room. I was about 28. And so I was greeted by these older guys, and they put their arms around me, and they sat me down. They held me throughout the meeting. I was shaking. I didn't really remember much about what the speakers were saying, and I really don't know how I ended up on Bedford Park Boulevard, which is a little bit of a distance from my parents' house, but I just walked. And so here I was sitting in the meeting. And after the meeting, they all sat around, and they talked to me, and they said, do you think you have a problem with alcohol? And I kind of thought about it for a second, and I said, yes, I do. And they kind of asked me to explain why I thought that. Is it because I can't keep a job? My marriage is falling apart. I can't stop drinking. I drink it 4 in the morning. I drink it, 24/7. I drank only on days ending with Y. It was just a constant thing for me because I was drinking all the time. And so they started explaining to me a little bit about this AA thing. I said, but I live upstate. Can I find AA upstate? And they laughed. They said, sure, just call up, look up in the phone book. And then I said, yeah, but. And then they said, the only but I've got is the one I sit on. And they gave me this advice that a lot of folks here in AA today is don't drink and go to meetings. And when your rear end falls off, pick it up, take it to a meeting. And if that doesn't work, go to meetings and don't drink. And no matter what, don't drink. And all the other fun stuff. And I really believe that. And so I went home. And I told my wife this wonderful revelation that I learned in the Bronx. And that I was no longer going to drink ever again. And I started going to meetings. I started going to meetings constantly. Several years ago, you get these things from the Social Security Administration that tells you like what you earned over the last 600 years. I looked at 1975, and I earned $63 that year. All I did was go to meetings. I went to meetings, morning meetings, noon meetings, night meetings, midnight meetings, candlelight meetings, meetings in other counties. I heard there was a great step meeting in Long Island. I drove down. I was like, go to meetings. I figure if I go to meetings, this is going to work. The only problem with that was that nobody ever told me to read the big book. They just told me, don't drink, go to meetings. It's great. And so I was doing everything that I was doing back when I was drinking. I was lying, cheating, stealing. People were cutting me off. I was cutting them off. I was stealing things from my job. I still wasn't a nice person, and my life was totally falling apart. My wife told me, you have to get out. And I didn't want to get out. I was comfortable. And I told her I wasn't drinking. And she told me I liked you better when you were drinking. At least I knew where you were. And so what happened was is that I started on this, spiritual search. And what led to that spiritual search, I think Peter had mentioned something just amazing. We all really have the same stories, just some of us use different words. I went to my home group, which is a young people Sunday night meeting in Warwick, New York, and a guy walked in the meeting and he said he came home from work, he had a lousy day, slammed the door, kicked the dog, yelled at the kids, almost hit his wife, but he didn't take a drink and it's okay. And everybody applauded. And I cried. I sat there and I said, there's got to be something more to this recovery. There's got to be something more to I didn't take a drink and it's okay. So I went on a search. I did things like call people up. I read every self-help book that's out there, every religious book that's out there. I got in touch with, old-timers. I was part of the AA Loaners Program through General Service Office. Was meetings by mail, people write to each other, and I picked people who came in like the 1940s to write to because I wanted to know what it was all about. And I got connected with Nell Wing over at General Service Office, and we hung out together, and I was going through some of the archives because I wanted to learn what it was, because I finally picked up a big book, and I read it, and I said, what's on the pages in that book is not in the rooms I was going to. And I went to thousands of meetings and all up and down the East Coast. Nobody was saying what was in that book. And so I wanted to read what they had. I mean, I read the stories. I kind of thought what they had, but I had no idea. So, AA Comes of Age was about the only history book that was out there. And so I just, being an alcoholic, I kind of knocked on the door of the archives and said, I want to learn. And Nell and I struck up a friendship, and she gave me a number of somebody to call because I told her I was on a spiritual search, and it was a priest in Havre de Grace, Maryland. And probably if anybody's been to treatment, you can lip sync his videos, Chalk Talk, and all the other ones. So I call up Father Martin, and I said, I think probably one of the most stupid things I've ever said in my life. I said, "You sound just like you do on the tapes." There was silence on the other end of the line, and it was, and then I realized what I had said, and I said, "No, really, you know." So he was speaking up in New Jersey right after that, and I said, "I'll go to hear you speak, and we'll talk afterwards." And he told me to go read Seven Story Mountain, Thomas Merton, and a couple other books. And I'm sitting there in the audience, and there's a seat empty in front of me, and the thing is like pretty much full. And the guy who comes out from behind the stage is wearing a Roman collar. He sits down in a seat in front of me, and he's talking to a friend of his who's sitting in the front row right in front of me. And, of course, I didn't say anything to him. I just kind of, like, cringed and froze. And he finished his talk, and I went, you know, he went backstage, and I sat there, and I said, oops, I blew that opportunity. And then so through this loaners program, what happened was is that I got introduced to somebody who was one of the pioneers of AA. And this guy Roger out in Elyria, Ohio, had told me if I want to, you know, get it right from the horse's mouth, I should contact this guy named Clarence Snyder because he was like one of the first, you know, original 100 members, and his sponsor was Dr. Bob, and I should, you know, and he gave me Clarence's address. Again, being a typical alcoholic, what I did was, why write? I called information, and I got his phone number. And I called up, and he wasn't home. His wife answered the phone. And then I was very disappointed that he wasn't home for me. He should have been there. He should not have been out doing what he was supposed to be doing. He should have known that I was going to call, and I needed help. But luckily, 5 minutes into the conversation, she said he's walking in the door, and we struck up a conversation. And right then and there, I heard in his voice the peace, the serenity. I heard the calmness. I heard all the stuff that I wanted in my life. And so we were calling and writing and calling and writing. And then the other thing that happened was is that I wanted him to take me through the steps because we talked about going through the steps. And I figured, being an alcoholic, I figured, you know, that I was going to, you know, go down to Florida and spend the weekend with him and go through the steps and be fixed. And then I called the airline and found out how much it cost to fly down to Florida. And I said, I don't want to spend that kind of money. And then I'd have to rent a car, you know. So what I did was I decided to hold a retreat in Middletown, New York. And you guys would pay for him to come up from Florida so I can go through the steps. I mean, that's... You know, and what happened was, I think there was about 30 people who came to this retreat at the Holiday Inn on April 4th, 1981. It ended up costing me, I don't know, because he came up with his wife. So I had to pay for their airline tickets together. I paid their hotel room. I paid their food. I think it ended up costing me, I don't know, $1,500 or something like that, and it would have cost me $300 to fly to Florida. God has got a very weird sense of humor. So I finally cornered him, and we went through the steps that weekend. And because I told him my life was falling apart, I was dying. I didn't want to die. I wanted to live. I wanted what he had. I wanted what the people in that book had. I was not going to take no for an answer. And if I had to, like, follow him home, I would do it. So that's what we did that weekend. And it was difficult. We got in, and what happened was it was pretty much I told him the story of my life. And some of the sane and rational things that I had done, you know, while drinking, like jumping across rooftops, running away from the police with no thought of falling down or getting myself hurt. And all the other stuff about my marriage and about my life and about how I drank and how I put things in my body that didn't really belong there and I didn't really care what it was. And so after about an hour or so, he looked at me and he said, "Well, do you think your life has been unmanageable?" And I said, "Definitely. My life, though I'm not drinking right now, is totally unmanageable." "Do you think you were powerless over alcohol?" I said, "Definitely." He said, "Okay, we just did step one." And I looked at him and I said, that's not what these people have been telling me for the last, like, almost 5 years. You know, can't do it that way. And then he said, well, is your way working? He said, no. You know, he's asked me, like, you know, if I believed in God. And I said, well, yeah, of course. And he said, well, explain what your belief is. And I told him, well, it is a little bit of Buddha, and it was a little bit of this and a little bit of that. And I, whatever God was, I made him up to be. And when I wanted to do bad things, I told God to kind of like look the other way. And he did. And that was my understanding of God. And it was exactly, you know, what I wanted him to be. So what happened with that was is that he told me that, you know, that was a God of my making, not a God of my understanding. And he asked me whether I thought that there was a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. And I said, definitely, because my way doesn't work. And he said, fine, you just did step two. And this went on. I mean, we did step three, and it was interesting. Nice Jewish boy from the Bronx getting on his knees and, you know, saying, Jesus, please, you know, and all this other good stuff. And it was just because that's what Clarence did. And Clarence said, if, you know, you want what I have, you do what I did, and that's it. And anytime I said, excuse me, can we talk about this? He said, well, you know, if you don't want what I have, then go find somebody else who has what you want. And opened the door to the room, and I did not want to walk out that door. So it was an interesting weekend. And my life totally changed after that. It, you know, I mean, things got worse at times, and things got better, and things got worse. But I got better. And then I started really delving into it and talking with Clarence about the history and about what it was back in those days, you know, that really worked. And I got a copy of a first edition, and I was reading the stories in there, and that even really turned me on even more. And I spent more and more time with Nell down in the archives and reading stuff. And you know, what I'm going to say is kind of like it's pretty much my opinion and what I've learned over a whole bunch of years in studying the history. And things change all the time, and new research comes out, and new things happen, and certain things that were facts 5-10 years ago are not facts today. I can remember several years back, there was this wonderful research done up at, I was up at Providence, Rhode Island, and at Brown University, and there was a symposium on AA, and there was like 25 of us there who were doing this thing, and somebody had gone to the Historical Society of Providence and found out that Roland Hazard wasn't treated by Dr. Jung because the records show that he was not in Switzerland at that particular time. He was somewhere else. Except recent information has come out saying, no, he wasn't in Switzerland at the time, but he was a year earlier. So, therefore, this wonderful revelation that he wasn't treated is totally untrue, but he was treated and, therefore, at a different time period. So, historical revelations change. And I've been studying the history for, I don't know, 27 years, whatever it is, reading everything I could, you know, finding, you know, old timers, traveling all over the country to find old timers and people who came in the early days, people came in the 40s and whatever. And I had the opportunity back in 81 or 82, I forgot, my memory is gone, to go to Lois's house, Lois and Bill's house, Stepping Stones in Westchester. And they had a long-termers day, anybody who came in before 1950. And since I was driving Clarence, they let me stay. And I had, I think it was 7 years at the time, so it was 82. And I'm sitting there like a kid in a candy shop. Because all these people, you know, who were, you know, talking about interesting stuff about, you know, identifying themselves as, hi, I'm recovered alcoholic. Because they all went around the room, and since there was about 140 of them, they only had a couple of minutes each to speak. That was the shortest talk Clarence ever gave. And so they all identified themselves pretty much as recovered alcoholics, and that was the first time I had heard that. I mean, other than from Clarence, because I thought Clarence was a strange guy. He was very controversial, and either you loved him or hated him. So I loved him, and everybody else I talked to at meetings didn't like it, and I got, I don't know, death threats and yelled at and kicked out of meetings from all these loving AA people. So I, you know, I sat there and I was talking to these folks and just really gathering up a wealth of information. And then when Clarence was diagnosed with cancer, he had asked me this. I still had yet to figure out to write his story in the history of AA in Cleveland. Out of like the hundreds or thousands of people he had sponsored over since 1938, here's this character, he asks to do this. I don't know what he saw in me and whatever, because I, other than like a college paper, I'd never written anything, you know. So I said, sure, you know, I'll do it. You know, make my sponsor a promise, make him proud of me. And I started writing this thing, and it's like, oh my God, you know, I mean, I could probably write fiction a lot easier than I could write nonfiction, because it's got to be true. And then I couldn't just write everything that he said, because I had to back it up, because I knew that somebody was going to say, like, that's not true. So I went around, again, interviewing people, reading stuff, going to archives, talking to people, and the stuff that I learned, you know, that AA, I thought was like this, you know, this program that they sat down, these old guys sat down and they wrote this thing, and it was a wonderful book, and it was like these people had like hundreds of years of sobriety behind them. And I realized that a bunch of day one dingbats wrote that book. Bill had what, just over 4 years? Bob had about 4 years. Everybody else had somewhere between, I think the average was about a year and a half. Of all the people who wrote that book, there was like nobody there with more than a little over 4 years. And today I hear at meetings, you know, you don't get your brains out of hock until after 5 years. We wouldn't have had that book if people in AA today were back then. I don't think we would have had AA today if people around today were back then. And so I said, like, this is, you know, you can recover. I went through the steps in a weekend. Nobody bought that one. You know, and it was great. It was easy. It was simple. He explained it to me so simply that an idiot like me could understand it. And so I was reading books, and you know, we were talking about the columns, you know, in the fourth step, and I came across this book. I've read just about every Oxford Group book that there is out there, because most of them are where the big book came from, and. In this book called I Was a Pagan by Victor Kitchen, it has what the Oxford Group called the game of truth. The whole change in direction of my life can best perhaps be illustrated through a version of the game of truth taught me by a member of the Oxford Group. You write down five things you honestly like most in life, and you write down five things you most hate. Then if any changes come into your life, you write them down again and show the comparison between your old life and the new life. So in this thing, there's pretty much two columns. It says, in my old life, I most like myself, liquor, tobacco, almost any other stimulant, narcotic form of self-indulgence. And in my new life, I most like God, time alone with God, the fellowship of living, the living Jesus Christ, the stimulation of the Holy Spirit. I hated most poverty for myself, prohibition, work. And today I hate most sin myself, because I is the middle letter of sin and sins that separate me from God. And I'm saying, this is the columns. This is the fourth step. This is, you know, the original idea where this came from, the game of truth. And then I kept rather reading other books. I was reading The Common Sense of Drinking, Richard Peabody. And I'm reading a story about a guy who, like, had problems in business. And he, like, said he's going to have to stop drinking. And he didn't drink for 25 years, and then when he retired, he got drunk and he died. And I'm saying, wait a minute, I've read this story somewhere before. And it's in the book. And then there was something in there about half measures or you know, will avail you nothing. And reading Shoemaker and finding more of AA in Shoemaker. And then reading what is the Oxford Group? Which I, like, totally loved, because, again, it's just about AA. It's you cannot belong to the Oxford Group. It has no membership list, subscriptions, badges, rules, definite location. It's a name for a group of people who, from every rank, profession, and trade in many countries, have surrendered their lives to God and who are endeavoring to lead a spiritual quality of life under the guidance of the Holy Spirit. I mean, that, you know, makes sense. The four activities of the Oxford Group is the sharing of our sins and temptations with another Christian life given to God, and to use sharing as witness to help others, still unchanged, to recognize and acknowledge their sins, surrender our life, past, present, and future, into God's keeping and direction, restitution to all whom we have wronged directly or indirectly, and listening to, accepting, relying on God's guidance, and carrying it out in everything we do or say, great or small. And this book was written in 1933. So, you know, all the stuff that's in that book was really not written by a bunch of day one dingbats. It was written by a whole bunch of folks in spiritual movements that have been around for a long, long time, reading about the Emmanuel movement, reading about the Washingtonians, and how some of the rules of the Washingtonians, you know, just like screaming out our traditions. And what they did, and they got involved in politics, and they got involved in money, and they got involved in all the stuff about getting celebrities and all kinds of people to be part of the Washingtonians, and how that led to the ruin of the Washingtonians. And AA tried to get all the parts of the Emmanuel movement and the Oxford group and the Washingtonians that didn't work and put them as guidelines in the traditions and in the steps and in the way the program is practiced so that we wouldn't make the same mistakes. And I find it fascinating that it was just not something that just came up out of thin air, because all these guys read all these books. One of the things that years ago when I first started collecting a lot of this stuff, it was pretty easy to get the books. Today, because now everybody wants them, their prices are ridiculously high, and a book I can get for $10, 15, 20 years ago, I would pay $300 for today. And so it's difficult. So it's the history I find is really important, because I think, you know, I think Frank Mauser once, one of the archivists at AA, once mentioned, it was a Carl Sandburg quote, and I'll paraphrase it, was that whenever a civilization or society declines or perishes, there's always one condition present, and that condition is they forgot where they came from. And today I'm finding in AA, and I love, you know, weekends like this in Fellowship of the Spirit, and listening to the little pockets of enthusiasm and the little pockets of people saying something got to work better than what we got. And something does work better than what we got. It's called Alcoholics Anonymous. And here's where I kind of like go onto my soapbox as far as that goes. It's, for me, what I'm seeing is what is kind of like taking AA away from its history and away from where we came from and away from who we were, was a desire to be all things to all people, not offend anybody, not scare anybody away, not make anybody, you know, walk out of the room or cry or offend anybody. And it became Burger King, you know, have it your way. One of the things that Henrietta Seiberling, the woman who introduced Bill and Bob, had said, because Bob and Bill both went to her and said, like, you know, we've been, you know, hearing all this stuff. People, you know, don't like all this talk about God, and they don't like all this talk about, you know, higher power. And should we take it out? Should we kind of like slow it down a little bit? And what she said made a whole lot of sense, and they kind of like forgot about that train of thought. And what she said is, alcoholics have been pleasing themselves their whole lives, and we're here to please God. And that to me makes a lot of sense. And yeah, I get in trouble at meetings sometimes because, you know, especially a lot of the hardcore meetings, and you know, if it's not in the first 164 pages, I don't want to hear about it. And then I bring in a book like What is the Oxford Group, and I start quoting, and they said, that sounds like the big book, but it's not. I said, that's where the big book came from. And they said, can you please leave? And I tell them, I said, you know, it's not just the 164 pages, not just not drinking. And that was another thing I found out was it wasn't for me just not drinking. Because I didn't drink for 5 years, and almost 5 years, and I was totally miserable. My life was miserable. Everything about me was miserable. I went to an anniversary meeting one day, and the guy was speaking, and he said he had 12 years of sobriety, and they'd been the worst 12 years of his life. And I called. I said, why don't you just go drink? So, I mean, one of the things I recommend to people over the years is if you can study the history and read the history, and there's tons of great history books out there. The Oxford group is amazing. And depending on points of view, I mean, if you want to read a strictly Christian point of view, Dick B. has got like 20-some-odd books on the spiritual roots, the biblical roots of AA. Mel B has got several books on history of AA. Ernie Kurtz is, I mean, I love his stuff. Spirituality of Imperfection was one of my most favorite books, even though it's really not the history of AA, but it's one of the most amazing books I've ever read as far as acceptance and the fact that we make mistakes and we screw up, and I make mistakes and screw up all the time. And there's stuff out there. And again, one of the other things I hear, because I know some people are going to go back to the meetings after this weekend, and it's like you're all on fire, and it's like a wonderful thing. And do you know what I heard this weekend? And they're going to look at you like you've got three heads, and, you know, and kind of like pretty soon seats next to you at the table are going to like be empty, and nobody's going to talk to you and that type of thing. Because you're only allowed to read conference-approved literature. Because I get in trouble bringing anything that's not conference approved in, you know, in a room. And what I also bring when I go, it's a little article, which box 459. I think that's something published by General Services of Alcoholics Anonymous, which talks about what any AA member reads is no business of GSO. Or of the conference, naturally. But when you see the emblem shown at the top of the article, you can be sure that the material has been tediously slow and sometimes torturous screenings. It may be even more important that all conference-approved AA material is exhibited clearly separate from other publications. It says is that, you know, GSO does not oppose any other literature. AA does not oppose any other literature. And when people tell you that only conference-approved literature, you know, you can tell them that AA says, unless they've changed it, which is possible, I've seen them do that, change things, you know, it's okay. You know, as long as it's recognized, especially for the newcomer who may get a little confused about certain things, because I've read some really strange things about sitting under a pyramid and an amethyst crystal kind of floating over your head, and if you do that for 18 hours a day, you will never drink again. I mean, some stuff is a little out there, and that maybe should be at a different table than conference-approved literature. But there's a lot of great stuff out there. And I find, you know, in my travels, there's a lot of people who really aren't interested in AA history and how that really, because it's like, you know, who cares what they did back then? I get yelled at all the time. I do a lot of like online stuff, and people say like, I really don't care what the old timers did, because as long as I don't pick up a drink, I'm gonna be sober. And I say, you're angry, you're this, you're that. It's like that's may not be, you know, officially not sober, but it's definitely not sober like behavior. And people don't, you know, don't want to know about the history. But the thing is that unless you know where we came from, you really don't know where we're going. And one of the great resurgences that I keep seeing is that little pockets like this, you know, come up. And people talk about, you know, studying the book, which is something, again, that nobody, when I first came around, did. Yes, people told me to read the 12 and 12. Until somebody pointed out to me, you know, in the big book, if you look in the front, which says lists all the literature, it tells you what the 12 and 12 is. It is an interpretive commentary written by a co-founder. Now, anybody in this room can write an interpretive commentary. As a matter of fact, a whole bunch of folks down in Akron, Ohio, including Dr. Bob, wrote an interpretive commentary, and Dr. Bob helped edit it and add to it and subtract to it and change it. Called the Little Red Book. That was an interpretive commentary, and it was very popular. Except some people in New York found out they weren't making any money on it, and so the 12 and 12 came out. That, I think, pretty much is like the history of like the 12 and 12 is because there was a book out there that was a commentary, an orthodox interpretation of the steps that worked and people really loved. So, you know, It's a commentary. It is not the program. The program is in there. And people also talk about, and I read a lot of stuff online about AA being a cult. I do agree that some members do exhibit some cult-like behavior because there are some strange people. You know, I mean, some of the meetings I've been to were very cult-like. I remember once, when I had about 25 years, went to this meeting and I said, you know, what do I have to do to join the meeting? And they told me I had to get a sponsor from that meeting. I had to go through the steps with that sponsor. I had to make a commitment to come there 3 times a week, and I had to go to all their speaking engagements. I said, but I've got 25 years sober, and like, I've got a sponsor. I don't need one of your sponsors. They said, well, you can't join the group. I said, traditions state that AA is open to all who wish to recover. And they told me to get out. They told me it was a closed meeting. And I said, but closed meeting means it's only open to alcoholics. They said, no, it's closed meeting to us and you get out. Yes, I mean, there is some cult-like behavior going on in AA. And I think some of the stuff about only conference approved and only this and only that, and some of the other strange things that have gone on, it is kind of cultish, and that's okay. You know what? I look at my life and where I probably would have been today, or not been today, and if you know, as I've heard people say, you know, brainwashed, and my brain definitely needed washing. And it's the most liberal cult there is, because I've been to meetings where you've got a Christians talking about Christian stuff, and you've got Wiccans talking about Wiccan stuff, and you've got Muslims talking about Muslim stuff, and you've got, you know, Jack's meetings where people are talking about the Torah, and you've got, you know, all, you name it, it's there, it's out there, depending on what part of the country you're in and what, you know, what country you're in. If it's a cult, it's like really the most accepting cult in the world, because no matter where you go, it's all going to be different. Except they're really saying the same thing. And I think one of the things that on my searches with the history is that, and just as a little aside with this display was, you know, one of the reasons I put to, you know, all, you know, track down all these photographs was I was reading the stories. I didn't know who these people were. And I'm a very visual person, and I think in pictures, and, you know, and I read words on a page, and it's nice. But I wanted to see what Archie looked like. I wanted to see what Bill D looked like. I wanted to see what all these other folks looked like. And I saw them, and their stories came alive. You know, I mean, I love Joe and Charlie, but you know what? The big book came alive to me when I saw pictures of who they were. I get totally excited with this stuff. It's absolutely amazing how beautiful, and the people that I've met over the years, some of the nicest people are in AA. I'm sure you guys know that. Some of the most terrible people are in AA. It's like everything else in life. You can walk down the street and meet nice people. You can walk down the street and meet terrible people. Just because we've recovered from alcoholism doesn't mean, you know, we become nice. I mean, if somebody's truly recovered, they become nice. I'll let you in on a secret. The ones who aren't nice, they may say they're recovered, but I mean, I could walk into me and say, I'm 6'4", I got blonde hair and blue eyes. Just by looking at me, you know that's not real. I could walk into a meeting and say, I'm recovered, and peel out in the parking lot after I've, you know, lifted your purse. I mean, you know, I'm not recovered. So it's for me, it's how I live and what goes on. And I think Pete had mentioned something about honesty, unselfishness, love, and purity earlier, which are the four absolutes coming out of the Oxford group. And most people don't know about that stuff, unless you're from Ohio. If you're from Ohio, you know about the four absolutes, because most of this stuff still has the four absolutes on it. And what I do for myself is I check my motives on a daily basis on those four things, knowing full well that I will never reach absolute anything, because absolute means perfect, and I will never be perfect, nor do I want to be perfect, because if I become perfect, it gets very boring. I've never met anybody who is perfect. Well, I have. They're all dead. And they were dead when I met them. And they can't do no wrong. So they're perfect. They can't make mistakes. They're just dead. So what I do is I try and, you know, check my motives on these four things. And I'll, you know, read you some of the basic stuff on them and see if they kind of like resounds a little bit with you as it has with me. And again, you don't have to do these perfectly. These are things you just check about, you know, things you do. And over, we must ask ourselves, is it true or is it false? This comes under honesty. For honesty is the eternal search for truth. It is by far the most difficult of the four absolutes for anyone, especially for us in this fellowship. The problem drinker develops genuine artistry and deceit. Too many, and we plead guilty, simply turn over a new leaf and relax. This is wrong. The real virtue in honesty lies in the persistent, dedicated striving for it. There is no relaxed twilight zone. It is either full speed ahead constantly, or it is not honesty we seek. And the unrelenting pursuit of truth will set you free, even if you don't quite catch up to it. We need not choose or pursue falsity. All we need to do is relax our pursuit of the truth, and falsity will find us. Under unselfishness, our unselfishness must include not merely that which we do for others, but that which we do for ourselves. I once heard an old-timer say that this was a 100% selfish program in one respect, namely that we had to maintain our own sobriety and its quality before we could possibly help others in a maximum degree. Yet we know that we must give of ourselves to others in order to maintain our own sobriety in a spirit of complete selfishness with no thought of reward. You know, this is not a selfish program. It's a self-caring program. It's selfish to the point of being, you know, maximum service to God and our fellow human beings. Under love, good question to ask ourselves on love might be, is it ugly or is it beautiful? We are the experts on ugliness. I cop to that. We have really been there. We're not experts on beauty, but we have tasted a little, and we are hungry for more. Love is beauty. Coming from the depths of fear, physical agony, mental torture, and spiritual starvation, we feel completely unloved, impregnated with self-pity, poisoned by resentment, and devoured by a prideful ego, which alcohol has brought to complete blindness. We receive understanding and love from strangers, and we make progress as we in turn give it to new strangers. Purity, people say, hey, purity, I'm definitely not pure. You know, I'm not like ivory soap, 99 of 44, 100% nothing. But purity pretty much is quality of both mind and heart. Perhaps we should say the soul of man. As far as the mind is concerned, it's a simple case of answering the question, is it right or is it wrong? In purity, as in honesty, the virtue lies in all our striving, like seeking the truth and giving all to the constant pursuit will make us free, even though we may never catch up to it. Such pursuit is a thrilling and challenging journey. The journey is just as important as the destination, however slow it may seem. And one of my favorite lines comes from a song, freedom's just another word for nothing left to lose. And I remember when I staggered into the rooms of AA, I had nothing left to lose. I was pretty much dead. My doctor told me I was pretty much dead. And if I kept going, I would be dead. I didn't want that. And so, you know, the thing is people talk about, you know, it was brought up also the question from the podium about the word recovered. And the book talks about recovered, and the old-timers talked about their recovered. And the example I love to give is that if I go out in the snow in a pair of jockey shorts and catch pneumonia, and I go to a doctor and he gives me medication and I recover from pneumonia, doesn't mean if I go in my jockey shorts I won't get pneumonia again. Doesn't mean cured either. However, kind of does mean cured. But it's a different type of thing. People say well, being recovered means you can drink. I mean, that's pretty much the primary answer I get from most people is that you can drink. And what I believe is that, and this is going to, you know, raise some eyebrows, but let me finish the statement and I'll explain it. I can drink. The problem is God has removed all desire to drink, so therefore I don't want to drink. Whether or not I can or can't, if I say I can't do something, I'm going to want to do it. I can drink if I want to, but I don't want to. Big Book talks about, you know, God has either removed your husband's liquor problem or he has not. What is our man willing to do to stop drinking forever? You know, we don't stay away from a drink one day at a time. This is, we live one day at a time. So I truly believe that one does and can recover. And again, going to a doctor if I'm sick, I don't ask for antibiotics that take 4 years to work. You know, I mean, I used to take antibiotics that I had to take like four a day for 10 days. I go there and ask for a Z-Pak now, which is like one a day for 5 days. So I can recover quicker. Because I don't want to be sick for 10 days. I don't want to be sick in my alcoholism for 10 days, 10 weeks, 10 years. I want to get better and I want to go on and I want to carry the message and I want to pass it on. And also carry the message, not a message. And the message is you can get well. And the message is that you can live a different life. Again, one of my favorite Bill Wilson quotes, and I'm not that big on Bill Wilson quotes, is that, paraphrasing, AA is a sort of kindergarten. It is something we go through to a better way of life and wider usefulness. And to me, that was what it's all about. It's not about being addicted to the rooms of AA. It's not about being, you know, I've met people who, like, if I don't go to a meeting tonight, I'm going to get drunk. They say, how long are you sober? 14 years. Something's wrong here. You know, it's fear-based. My recovery is not based on fear. If anybody's read the so-called promises, I mean, other than the first one about we recovered from alcoholism, it says we will know a new freedom and a new happiness. You know, the fear of this will leave us. The fear of that will leave us. The fear of that will leave us. It's about the release of fear. And if I'm afraid that I'm going to pick up a drink if I don't go to a meeting, what if I'm stuck somewhere where there are no meetings? What am I going to do? I'm going there. I mean, I do great by myself in prayer if there's no meetings, if I'm stuck somewhere, if I can't drive somewhere, if my internet is down and I'm in a blackout and I can't use the phone, whatever it is, you know what? I get on my knees and I pray and it's a wonderful meeting. Because wherever two or more are gathered for recovery, it's a meeting. And the same way Clarence never changed sponsors, I never changed sponsors. We used to go around the room saying, like, do you have a home group and do you have a sponsor? And I say, yes, I have a home group. I have a sponsor and he's dead. People didn't like that, you know, because unless I have any, you know. I have sponsors. I have people that I relate to and talk to in the fellowship. And I have Clarence. And just the way he never, you know, got another sponsor and never, you know, whatever it is, Clarence is my sponsor. And I talk to him all the time. And he talks to me and God talks to me through all of you. And all of them and all the people who came before me talk to me through people like you who come to weekends like this and who go on and get on fire and carry the message and learn what it really is all about in there. Because that's what it's all about. It's in that book. The directions are in that book. I mean, in the multilith, in the pre-publication copy, it talks about, you know, rarely we've seen a person fail who's thoroughly followed our directions. It also says if you're not convinced at this point, either reread the book or throw it away. It says that, no further authentication is necessary, and why are we coming out with hundreds more books for further authentication? This is authentication. This works. I mean, I work in the mental health field, and we're talking about evidence-based practices. This is an evidence-based practice. It works. What doesn't work is being all things to all people, have it your way, being open to every idea possible, whatever you want, you can have it. People had to want this thing. Sister Ignatia always talked about, like, saying, you know, when she gave the little Sacred Heart medallion, and she said, like, if you ever think of picking up a drink, return this to me. Very few were returned. And somebody once took her to a window and said, that bar across the street, all those people in there need AA. And she said, AA is not for people who need it. It's for people who want it. If you truly want it, and if you truly want to, like, turn your life, and you truly are motivated, is a clinical word, have the desire, you can have it. You can recover. You can never pick up a drink again the rest of your life. You can be happy, joyous, and free. You could have everything your heart desires as long as that's what God wants for you. I found out years ago that God did not want me to have a Rolls Royce. It's a funny story behind that because I always prayed for one. And I was living in Maybrook, New York, and I woke up one morning and I looked out the window and there's a Rolls Royce sitting in my driveway. And I, thank you, God. And I walked outside, the guy standing there, I thought it was my chauffeur. And he said, I broke down. Is it okay if I, like, can we push it back to, you know, the back of your driveway and, like, until I get somebody to come tow it? I was heartbroken. I yelled at God and I said, you tease me. And like I said, God's got a very weird sense of humor. And he goes, ah, gotcha. You know, I used to have a T-shirt that said, God is weird. Look at a giraffe. I mean, God is weird. A platypus, you know. I mean, come on. But the whole thing is that, yes, you will have everything that your heart desires if we seek his will for us and the power to carry that out. And that's what it comes down to. And I think I have some time left, I guess, maybe. So I guess, I don't know, maybe entertain some questions. Because, you know, I can give you a whole bunch of stuff that you may not want to hear. And I personally prefer, like, giving people stuff what they want to hear. Because that's, for me, that's the best present to get is something that I want. I've gotten so much stuff over the years that I really didn't want, and I re-gifted it. Except a couple of years later, I found out that I gifted it back to the same person who gave it to me. So that's embarrassing. So, I mean, I'm willing to entertain any questions coming from the floor. Thank you. Sure. Four absolutes are absolute on honesty, unselfishness, love, and purity. As a matter of fact, this little pamphlet I read from is still available from Alcoholics Anonymous, Cleveland, Ohio, from Cleveland Central Office. And Akron and Chicago. It's called The Four Absolutes. If one, you know, I mean, get it like a Chicago literature list, they got tons of great stuff. I mean, they print their own stuff. And Cleveland has some great stuff. Akron's got some great stuff. There's some stuff that's out there that's amazing. That, you know, I used to, when I was chairing a group, I just ordered tons of stuff from all over the country, and people came just to get the literature. They left because they didn't like what we were saying, but they wanted the literature. All right.
Hi, Mitch. My name's Danny. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Danny.
Hi. Thank you so much. You say that you went through the 12 steps with Clarence in a weekend,
mm-hmm.
right? Okay, good. So, and then Clarence claims, I know, like in Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers, he claims he had a 93% success rate in his thing. Did Clarence ever advocate going through the steps more than once?
Clarence's thing was that, okay, this is, again, wait till I finish the statement. You do the first nine, you live in the last three. The only time you do the first nine again, they're on two occasions. First occasion is if you resign and resume, which means you pick up a drink.
Mm-hmm.
Second occasion is when you're taking somebody else through the work. So the more you work with newcomers, the more you go through the steps over and over and over and over. So it's not just 10, 11, 12, this is what I'm living the rest of my life. If you're taking a newcomer through the steps, you're doing 1 through 9. You're doing it with them, and you're doing it all over again because you do it when you do it with a newcomer. So it sounds like you do the first 9, live the last 3, but a lot of people seem to forget about the fact that we're supposed to be working with newcomers, and we're supposed to be taking people through the steps. So you're constantly doing them.
Just really quickly, thanks again for everything. Very quickly, one of the things I was taught, like with AA history and the importance of AA history, and how important that is. I know Bill has a tape or a CD. It's a Founders Day from Cleveland, and this guy Larry B, who I guess his sober date is 1943, he's sharing in Cleveland, and he says, he comes up to the podium. He says, "My name is Larry. I'm a recovered alcoholic. All the alcoholics are still out there drinking." This makes it real simple. Yeah. Thanks a lot, Mitch.
I've met Larry a couple times. Great guy. When I was out there in '88, I was interviewing a lot of the old timers and Larry and a whole bunch of the other folks who came in the 40s. I mean, again, they're all amazing people. I used to go to a Cleveland East Side meeting and whatever, and it was just sitting there, and like the average sobriety in the room was 30 years. And I just blown away constantly. Yeah.
Hi, I'm Beverly, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Beverly.
I'm just kind of interested in what you said about you have a sponsor and he's dead.
Mm-hmm.
I know common AA fellowship thinking is that, you know, men with the men, women with the women, and that everybody should have a sponsor. And right now, I don't have a female sponsor. My sponsor right now is a man. So I just wanted to know historically how the program views sponsorship, and why don't you have a sponsor?
Historically, how it viewed sponsorship was, well, Dr. Bob was always against, from the beginning, women coming into AA, because one of the first women who came into AA at King School Group caused a ruckus. Because it was, nobody concentrated on the meeting. It was like all about her, and can I get you a cup of coffee? Can I get you a chair? Can I do, you know? And then it became even weirder. But Clarence sponsored women, you know. Again, you know, I would prefer, you know, men with the men and women with the women. If, you know, and I've sponsored several women who, like, you know, there were countries, like, I want what you have. Nobody around here's got it. And I said, I will do it on one condition. You're the one that got it after I give it to you, and you give it to other women. And then the next one you take through the work, they're with you. And then by the time, you know, so short period of time is gone by, you've got a half a dozen women out there that people can choose from. So, again, if my motives are correct, nothing's going to happen. And, again, it's a matter of discernment. It's a matter of, like, really seeing. It's not like, you know, if somebody says, like, you know, can you be my sponsor? I always ask them why. Oh, because you got 30-something years. I said, so what? You know, what does that mean? It means I haven't had a drink in 30-something years. Who cares? What do I got? What do you want? The big book says if you want what we have and are willing to go to any lengths to get it, what do I have? Well, you got 30-something years. Stop that. What do I have? Come to meetings with me, follow me around, talk to me, spend time with me, and then ask. You know, so, and as far as why don't I have a sponsor, I do have a sponsor, but he's dead. I don't find, you know, what I truly believe all a sponsor is a guide through the steps. The original term sponsor came from the fact that people were sponsored into meetings. You couldn't go to an AA meeting. Mm. You had to go, at least in the beginning, go to a hospital, get detoxed. You were assigned a sponsor. That sponsor was responsible for you to make sure you visit. I mean, I have all the hospital rules for some of the clinics that they used in Cleveland. The sponsor had to say so about who would visit, when they would visit, what they could bring. The sponsor responsible was taking you to your first meeting, taking you through at least the first three steps before you went to the first meeting. So you were sponsored into AA. You just couldn't walk in a room because, I mean, people today walk in a room, and you're right, there's a lot of people in AA who aren't alcoholics. Nowhere near alcoholics. It just doesn't make any sense sometimes. Again, it's like it's a numbers game. People want lots and lots of numbers. I would rather have a meeting with 10 people who, like, really want recovery and are willing to do the work and carry it to the newcomer who is sick and suffering than have a meeting with 100 people who, like, don't get it. And, you know, again, I don't need a guide through the steps.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I do need a fellowship around me. Mm-hmm. I do need a support system. I do need friends. I do need people I can bounce stuff off of. I do need people to sit there and tell me, like, you know, you're out of your mind. You know, what's happening? What's going on? You know, what are you doing? You know, how come you're wearing the same jeans 4 days in a row? You know, I need that. You know, I need people to, like, call me on my stuff. But I don't need a guide through the steps. Except
okay.
If I decide one day to say, like, the heck with it, and I can take my will back and my power back and give up on God, which I'm not going to do, and resign or resume, which it's not in the cards because I have no interest, because I've had a million excuses but never a good enough reason.
Thanks.
Thanks.
Hi, sir. How are you? My name is Lance. I'm a real alcoholic. I was just wanting to. I'm a little curious about my own family history and stuff like this. What's your experience with basically the 24th Street Clubhouse and the Al-Anon Family Group?
The old clubhouse was really nice. It was funny because, matter of fact, Bill and I had gone down to meet with a guy whose father used to attend the old clubhouse, and as a child. And he used to kind of play there, and Lois would kind of like hang out with him, whatever it is. It was a really nice. I mean, Bill lived there for a while. It's funny. It was probably one of the last clubhouses in New York, because I can go to just about any state, any country, and there's going to be a clubhouse. There's going to be a place. There's going to be a building. There's going to be a storefront. Except somehow or other, New York doesn't have those things.
Or basically, my second and third question to you is, my friend, what was basically like the membership in 1958 or something with the Al-Anon Family Group? Would you know anything of that?
I'm not sure about the membership in Al-Anon and the family groups. I know back in the beginning, AA was open to alcoholics and their families. So out of the 100 people who were mentioned in the book, probably at least 30 or 40 of them were spouses or significant others. There were only about 40 or 50 alcoholics, and the rest of the people who were counted were not. As a matter of fact, in the first edition, Marie B., is a story about a wife who was pretty much was the first Al-Anon story ever written. And Ann Smith used to, have little things around the kitchen table and whatever. So it was a big thing, back in the early days where families were involved. And again, what's become sad with the open meetings and the closed meetings, and you're not allowed here. One of the early founders of Dewey Spies from Cleveland moved out to San Mateo, California, and he died several years back. And his wife had been attending meetings with him since the early 40s. And after he died, they wouldn't let her back in the meeting. And she just was totally devastated. We talked on the phone constantly, and she just... She's like, why don't they want me back in the meeting? Because she's not an alcoholic.
One last question. So the Towns Hospital in New York City, I know this is Alcoholics Anonymous. So what was basically the ratio to I know that there was a lot of people that were treated for morphine addiction that were basically gassed through the First World War that were definitely addicts. What was the ratio between alcoholics and the people that were dead? I should say the United States government became addicts, made addicts. What was the differentials in patients?
I'm not sure. I'm not really that familiar with Towns' records, but I also know that there are a lot of people in AA who were involved with. Dr. Bob was a pillhead. Lots of folks used pills and goofballs and everything else. There was always a large percentage of people in AA who were also addicts. Back in Lexington, Kentucky, at the federal penitentiary, there was they started in 1946, I believe it was, a Addicts Anonymous meeting. And with the help of Bill and, as a matter of fact, in some of the early grapevines, they mentioned that they supported these folks. So there's always been addicts in AA.
But what my center question is basically was for a lot of the sick and suffering people that were, I guess they were on the top floors, that were gassed. What were they working a 12-step program with them also?
I'm sure Silkworth did a lot of stuff. He used. I mean, the system was pretty much the same. What worked for addicts a lot of times was that. But I think from my readings on some of the early stuff is that I think the medical model was more used for people who were addicted to other substances, and AA and alcohol, the 12 steps are used more with people with alcoholism. I mean, one of the great history books on the history of the recovery industry is a book called Slaying the Dragon by Bill White, and I found that to be total wealth of information about the history of recovery, including all the cures and the narcotic stuff and Synanon and everybody else.
Is there any kind of archives that I could find out on a reference to the Towns Hospital?
Do you know of anything, Bill? Nothing that I know of. There are some materials that Dr. Silkworth's family has with letters and things like that. no record. I mean, I know somebody had found the record of Bill's discharge dates and all this other stuff and how long he stayed there, but I'm not sure where those records might be.
Okay, thank you, sir.
Okay.
My name's John. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, John.
My sponsor is dead, too, and personally, I find it hard to act in a certain way when I think about my sponsor. I don't know. I have a question. Clarence was in toward the end of his life. Was you're surrendering to Jesus? Was this always the way he did that? I mean, I've seen his third step prayer is very very Christian based. Was it that way in the 40s, or was this a different? Because it seems like he shifted over time.
Well, Clarence was always a Christian. I mean, some of his early letters. Matter of fact, one of his first letters that he wrote to Hank Parkhurst back in probably late May of 39 was saying that there's not too much stress on the spiritual and the religious stuff at the meetings. So there was a shift. And this is where I kind of like break with a lot of the later Clarence people. Where they don't talk to me, and I'm not like, I'm a persona non grata in lots of circles. I mean, GSO, Clarence's folks. A lot of the change came after he married Grace. Yeah. I put on several retreats with Clarence in New York, Middletown, Peekskill, a few other places, and they were AA retreats. The Christian stuff came after the retreats. People talked about what they wanted to talk about. I mean, if a speaker wanted to talk about their relationship with Jesus, that's fine. As part of their story, their experience, strength, and hope. But the prayer and praise and all the other stuff came after the retreat was officially over because there's no longer an AA function.
Right.
After Clarence passed on, again, I get in trouble with this, they started taking people through the steps in groups and whole rooms full, which they never did when I knew Clarence when he was alive. It was always one-on-one because Clarence, you know, work with one person, maybe two people on a weekend, if that. Now it's the entire room and the whole thing is to save souls. And, you know, that's them, you know, bless them for it. It's a great thing, you know, but the thing is I find, for me, what I got, what I learned and who I got it from is different than what it is today. And I try and stick true to what I got.
Was he in the 40s having people surrender to Jesus specifically, or was that later?
That was later. Okay. One of his sponsees, Irv Meyerson, who was a Venetian blind salesperson who started AA in West Virginia, Atlanta, Georgia, and several other states, is Jewish. Several letters from Irv, you know, that I had from Irv to Clarence talks about celebrating the Jewish holidays and doing this. And okay. Mentioning good. Yiddish words and explaining to Clarence what they were.
Right.
And so there was no reference to any of that other stuff in there. And again, okay. I think most of that came with, I mean, one of the things, again, with the Oxford group and with, it was like, it was Jesus. And it didn't matter what denomination, it didn't matter whether you were Catholic Jesus right. or Protestant Jesus or Russian Orthodox Jesus, it was still Jesus. You know, that was the God as we understand him kind of a thing. It was like, it was the same person, but depending on what denomination you were, it didn't matter. So, but I think the earlier Clarence stuff, where he's taking people through the steps, it was more of, this is who you are, this is what you did, and if you're Jewish,
right,
that was it. That was it. 5 minutes? Okay.
Just one quick question. He formed a beginner's meeting early on in Cleveland. Mm-hmm. Did they take the steps there, or was it just merely a method of presentation?
It was an indoctrination of taking the steps from some of the old-timers came in. It was the Crawford Road men's group.
Right.
And they started the beginner's meetings, and people from D.C. and all the other places, you know, that's where a lot of that
right.
beginner's meetings came from, were
but,
those.
But they didn't take it. Did they take
yeah.
the steps? In
well,
the
what happened was is that they were getting like hundreds and hundreds okay. of people coming in, and they didn't have enough sponsors. So what they did was, in a group, you know, two or three old-timers came and did the classes.
Hi, my name's Laura, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Laura.
And I want to thank you for coming and sharing that the history was very interesting. My question is, in my experience, I've been here about a year, and I've worked the steps now two times. I'm almost through with my amends the second time, and I'm feeling that I haven't done a thorough enough job, and I feel that I need to start over. And but part of me, like listening to you, you said before that we work the steps once and then we continue. My question is basically, in our book it says that after we do step 10, we continue to grow in understanding and effectiveness. And I have several people that their experience has been they continue to work the steps. And should I, where I'm at right now, if I start working with others, is this stuff going to go away? Or is this something I need to start working the steps again?
I'm constantly making amends. I mean, people come into my life that I haven't seen in years. And all of a sudden, it's like I'm walking down the street and it's, Mitchell, I owe you money. You know, this totally, you know, escaped my mind. And all of a sudden, I mean, I had that once. Somebody drove up. They were visiting their sister down the block from where I lived. And it was like, you know, hey, I owe you some money. I'll give you a check. Cash it in 2 weeks. It, you know, it's constantly. It's a never-ending process because there's stuff that I did out there that I have no recollection of because I was either, like, totally out of it or whatever it is. And I'm reminded constantly of it. And the fact of, like, you don't think you've done a thorough enough job because it's never ending, so there's never a thorough enough job. Nobody ever completes it. I mean, people say the only step that you do perfectly is step one. Please. I don't do any step perfectly because it's impossible. You can't do anything perfectly. And I'm always doing that stuff. And the thing is, for me, and when one of the things Clarence told me was that anytime I had a problem with any step after three, he said, how come you didn't do three? I said, what do you mean? I did three. He says, well, then you shouldn't be having a problem with six. Because I made a decision to turn my life and my will over the care of God, then I have no business having a problem with anything. Okay. They'll happen. They'll come. You know, why reinvent the wheel? Just keep working it.
When you have fear and resentment come up and you do a four-column inventory, who do you take, who do you go to share that? Then
go with, I mean, there's not that much anymore in life that I'm really afraid of. I mean, sometimes I panic 2 minutes. And I just, I mean, most of the stuff, I pray. Okay. And I also talk about it with people I know and trust. I mean, there are certain people in AA that I trust my life with. And out of AA, people who are like friends and people I love and care about who, like, I can just trust them with anything and share, like, when I'm going out of my mind. Okay. And so it's like, again, I've done the steps. I do them all the time when I'm working with somebody else. And when anything comes up, I have means. AA has given me a means to live my life. Thanks.
Hi, my name is Frank. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Frank.
And I just wanted to know, do you have a relationship with Wally P? Have you spoken?
Wally's an old friend. I haven't spoken to him recently. As a matter of fact, I helped Wally with his research on Back to Basics with the old beginners classes. Wally and I go back years ago when I went to Southwest Archives Convention with him and a whole bunch of other places.
And did you find the Back to Basics program really effective for newcomers?
I don't know. I mean, I haven't been to any of them. I don't know. I mean, I've seen some of his stuff on his website, but I know the beginner's classes in Cleveland were. So if he's using, you know, I mean, I've got some of the first drafts of Wally's book, and he was using it, but I understand a lot of that's been changed. It worked. I mean, you know what? Anything going back to the basics works. If it's back to that, it works. No matter what you call it. You know, whether it's one from column A, two from column B, it doesn't matter. But if it comes from there, it works.
Unfortunately, where I'm from, the local people say it's not AA, so we can't call ourselves a group. They want to shut it down.
I think, I forgot who it was with us. Chris or Pete talked about how, like, the primary purpose of an AA group is to teach the steps. And I think Back to Basics is about teaching the steps, and no matter what you call it. Yeah, it may not be AA because it's not officially following the traditions and all this other stuff, but you know what? I don't care whether it's AA, rational recovery, smart recovery, any other kind of recovery. If somebody gets well, that's the point. I don't care whether they find it through a church, through a kindergarten school, whether they find it on a street corner or anywhere. If somebody recovers and gets well and gets their lives together and has families through a church, through a kindergarten school, whether they find it on a street corner or anywhere, if somebody recovers and gets well and gets their lives together and has families restored and has all this other stuff going on, that's God's work. It doesn't have to be AA.
One other question. Have you tried the two-way prayer that he,
I haven't, like, kept up with Wally's stuff. He's like, you know, he's like, move too fast for me.
Okay.
I'm more involved with this stuff than trying to keep up with Wally and some of the, his stuff.
Thanks.
Thanks.
One more? It's quick. All right. Hi, I'm Jason. I'm a recovered alcoholic.
Hi, Jason.
Just a quick question for you. In your experience with doing the steps with Clarence that weekend, did you do the fourth step in accordance with how the big book lays it out or how it was laid out by him and is going through the steps pamphlet?
I had done, and a lot of the people Clarence worked with were people who've been around for a while. I had done the columns. I had done a autobiography. I had done a pre- and postnatal inventory. I had done a blueprint for progress. I had done a poor guide. I had, you name the fourth step thing, I had done it already. And what Clarence and I did, we went over a list of character defects. Do you have you ever had this defect? In what ways have they manifested themselves in your life? We identified the defects because the fifth step says, submit it to God, to ourselves, and another human being, the exact nature of our wrongs, not the stuff I did. I have to identify, like, when lust is coming up, this is what it is. When greed is coming up, this is what it is. The only thing that other stuff is great for is when you're making amends list. But for me, for the inventory, since I had done all that stuff, we just went over all these defects and identified it, and so I could understand when it's in play in my life. And I can sit there today and say, uh-oh, you know, I'm doing this again. And that's where I also use the four absolutes, and that's where I also use some of the other identification pieces. But, again, you know, they, people say they want the program the way the founding members had it. They didn't have it. This book was written after the founding members came in. So this is not how the founding members got it. This is, I mean, the Game of Truth has got the columns, but it was similar. The founding members didn't, you know, the first 40 or 50 people didn't have steps. Despite what it says about the six steps, you know, in AA Comes of Age and some other places, there were no six steps. There's no evidence of any six steps prior to 1953. So the founding members didn't get it from here, so they got it from somewhere else. But this is what their experience was, and that's what they wrote down, and that's what came after that. So ever since April 1939, this was the program. Before that was something different.
Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you all.